James, we are slightly below 3,000 total downloads.
Nice.
Just a hair.
Nice.
Just a hair.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see how we'll see how that number drops off after we drop on my Brewer Rant podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. At this point, once this goes live, people should have heard that. So no one may be listening anymore.
Oh, that's true. Yep. Nice. Ah, my mom said I'd achieve great things.
I was at a brewery yesterday and
shocker.
Telling people, well, yeah, I know. Amazing. I needed something to do for an hour. It's, I have this horrible habit now. If the kids need to be somewhere and it's for under 90 minutes, I don't consider that enough time to go home and then go back again. So I just head over to the brewery in the middle of town.
However you have to justify it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's a problem. But I was telling folks about as of today, upcoming brewery rant, which again, listeners who are still remaining, both of you, you've heard already. And as I'm telling them this, I'm drinking a passion fruit wheat beer. I understand the irony.
That's fine. Again, nothing wrong with your passion fruit wheat beer. That's okay. Actually, Kona Brewing Company makes a lovely Lilikoi wheat. What Lilikoi is passion fruit, and it's quite nice.
Kona makes some good stuff. It's very good stuff. They used to have a coconut porter, which I think was the first thing I tried of theirs.
Yeah. Was it stateside here?
Yes.
Yeah, that's all brewed out in Portland. but the brewery in Kona, Kailua Kona in the Big Island, Hawaii, is fantastic. It's a restaurant. They do pizza and stuff, but they also do, it's more like your traditional brew pub. And their Lilikoi there, Lilikoi wheat is really nice.
If it's in Hawaii and they serve pizza, does everything have to have pineapple on it? Because I couldn't handle
it. I think
that.
It's a state mandate, but, they buck the trends. You know, they're brewers, so they're like, ha, we're not putting pineapple on our pizza.
Okay, they just earned some extra bonus points from me then, because that's plain gross. So anyway, almost 3,000 downloads. Very excited about that. Please tell your friends. Let's get some more numbers up there for us. It makes us happy and proud to be providing this information when we see those numbers go up. We're slaves to social media like anyone else. We like seeing the likes. But in all seriousness, reviews on iTunes and Google Play and all that actually really help to spread the word. So please give us a couple of stars there, or actually a couple stars would suck. Give us 5 stars.
Five stars would be great.
Yes. Much appreciated.
Come on, Lithuania. You owe us.
Oh, yes. We know we've got friends in Lithuania
yep,
now.
So. And Estonia and all over the place. So
let's get on it here. We need to maybe spend an entire episode saying the word hops in 87 different languages just for fun, just for sound bites. So I guess we should talk about something relevant instead of babbling on about social media. Okay. I kind of covered that.
Yep. Okay.
How about harvest? Is it time?
Ooh. Boy, we're right on the cusp. Well, and some of our friends in further south in the States have already started harvest. So, yeah, it is absolutely time.
All right, buckle your seatbelts, people.
Here we go. Let's think about this. So we've got listeners who are at all sorts of scales here. So why don't we talk about sort of the opportunities for harvest, like hand harvesting versus small machine harvesting versus large machine harvesting, because that's going to, I think, be indicative of the people's scale, right? So let's talk about that and sort of the compare and contrast. And then we can talk maybe about, how you figure out when it's time. And something I've never seen really anybody talk about, which is the difference between the technical correct time to harvest and the opportune time to harvest. They're two different things usually.
Yep. So when it comes to hand harvesting, really the only thing you need is a ladder and some aleve, I think.
Yep. So yeah, you're literally pulling cones off of sidearms. And the more hands you have, many hands make light work. It is just going for it and hand stripping those cones off of those sidearms. What we found seems like a lifetime ago. We did a study looking at the efficiency of hand harvesting on, let's call it, a very small commercial basis. So you've got plants that are yielding like a pound and a half dry, so a commercial yield, and you're going to strip these buggers by hand. We found was that it takes a single person 45 minutes to an hour to hand pick one plant. So, you know, you could have two strings on that. That's fine. But, I mean, that's a quite the commitment. And you figure that you've got, I don't know, 1,000 crowns to the acre, let's just say. That's a lot of hours. And you start doing the math and backing into it, saying, I've got X amount of time to get this variety off. You'll figure out pretty quickly either how long your days are and how many hands you're going to have. So what we found was that the point of diminishing returns for hand harvesting was typically about 2/3 to 3/4 of a single plant. And what I mean by that is by the time you just want to be done with that vine and move on to the next one, because it's like a sense of accomplishment. As people got close to sort of the end of that particular vine they were working on, they got sloppy. The yield that was in the lower quarter to lower third of that twine was not worth the effort that it was costing you.
And let's be clear here in terms of the, I'm picturing this in my mind, and I want to make sure folks understand, at least when I hand harvested on the farm, we were decapitating, we were pulling the vines down. So you had the ability to traverse the vine and start with the denser areas first, and to your point, kind of slack off where things aren't dense. That's as opposed to actually leaving your vines up and having to climb.
Fair. Yep, that's very fair. So yes, I am talking about decapitation harvesting, where you're literally cutting the plant out of the field. And for a commercial yield that I'm talking about, that's really your only option. You would be on a ladder for hours. It would probably, I would say, double to triple the amount of time it would take you to hand harvest a plant if you left it standing. Some people will drop the plant. They'll untie it, they'll drop the plant, and then they'll tie it back up. And the idea here is that, well, the plant's going to have all this extra time to photosynthesize. You know, you're going to have 6 to 8 weeks, potentially, of photosynthetic time before that plant wants to go dormant. That's all mathematically fine and dandy, but you can't stop caring for that plant from a disease and insect point of view after you harvest it. It's like, oh, harvest is done, my plants are up, I'm going to go let them go dormant, but are you caring for them still? Usually not. I am a proponent of just cutting them out of the field and taking them someplace, stretching them out, you know, in a barn, get them out of the sun while you're doing it, because they'll wilt, you know, much more slowly that way, and harvest that way. Otherwise, you're just going to be killing yourself. You're not likely going to take care of your plants post-harvest anyway, so...
And what, if anything, is the value of those stripped binds afterwards from a market value? There really isn't anything, but is there any value from a mulching and putting back into the soil perspective? We talk about all the nutrient leaching that goes on. Are there nutrients there that would benefit?
Oh, absolutely. Let's put some caveats on this. Number one, the plant matter, leaves, binds, and whatnot, are composted before we spread them back on the field. Composting, proper composting, which we can talk about maybe off season, is very important to do it correctly to kill off pathogens and insects and all that kind of stuff before you spread it back on your field. Of course, if you had a pristine field, it wouldn't matter. You could just, you know, go and toss the leaves back on there and, you know, there you go. But you can gain back like up to half of the potassium you put on in that season by putting the leaves back on the field. So it's no joke. I mean, it can contribute considerably, but it can also be a bad thing if you've got a lot of disease, you've got a lot of insects, aphids, mites, things like that, that you're just going to be putting that leaf litter back on the field without composting it and having killed those insects. You're just going to create a problem over problem next year. So I would avoid that. But you brought up an interesting point about the binds. We have made ourselves like wreaths out of binds, out of old binds once they've been stripped. While they're still pliable and green, you wrap them around a form and sort of weave them, and then you let them dry, and then boom, you've got something to sell. And like some of them we're selling for 50-60 bucks a pop.
Wow.
The other thing we would do is we would take those old binds and we would work with our artist community, and they would come out and get them and take them and work them into their artwork, whether they were weaving with it or, you know, building something with it. And, you know, we get some props out of it. You know, you go to an art show, say, hey, this is, you know, waste material. So that was kind of fun. But other than that, there isn't a whole lot of use for the vine itself.
Interesting. I love the artistic bent there and being able to do just something else with that material. That's great.
And the issue there is time, right? So you've got, you've just stripped these vines, and you really got to get them while they're still pliable and get them wrapped around these forms. So it's like, you know, if you really want to do it right, you have a small secondary crew who isn't harvesting, but they're using those vines, wrapping them around your forms. And
Since at that point, of course, your dryer is ready to go and it's working flawlessly.
Of course, absolutely. It. Yep, totally.
Now, I know we spoke about this a bit when we talked about pre-harvest logistics, but just to reiterate, since we're talking about the vines, if you decapitation harvest and you're then bring those vines over somewhere to strip them, whether it's by hand or via a harvester, they are heavy.
They are.
So we've talked before about layout and all that, but this is why we say you want to be able to drive a truck between your rows, because you got to put the vines somewhere. You're not going to decapitate 5 or 6 vines and just drag them back to the barn yourself. It's unpleasant.
Very unpleasant. And
so have a plan.
You will get so much hop rash on your arms and face and neck, and you look like you got drugged behind a truck. So let's just wrap up the hand harvesting first before we move on. But I mean, that moving vines is no small feat. And you should at least consider a pickup truck to put binds in, to haul them around, to get them where you're going. How you load those binds in that truck for hand harvesting really doesn't matter, but the care you take in loading binds onto a wagon or a truck if you're mechanically harvesting is the difference between being efficient and not being able to get your crop off. So we'll talk about that in a minute, but just keep in mind that, you know, for what we would consider a mature commercial yield, you're looking at 45 minutes to an hour per person, per plant to hand harvest. And if you've got 5 days on average to get that crop off, that particular variety off, do the math. And that will tell you sort of what you've got to work into. Now, granted, if you've just got spindly plants and you just want to be in this for yucks and have people over and drink beer and eat barbecue, then knock yourself out. But for those of us trying to do this commercially, honestly, hand harvesting is not a viable long-term option.
It can be a punishment for someone that's not carrying their weight.
It can be very much a punishment. It usually is after about 20 minutes. It's awful. So, yeah, been there, done that. We hand harvested, you know, an acre, and it was arduous at the very best of times. I don't advise it. Shortly after that, we had invented and built a small-scale mechanical harvester.
And I recall, you know, something else about hand harvesting, and it's the little things that make all the difference. It's summer. It's hot. If you are going to be taking all of your binds, you know, if it's not inside, but to some central location in your yard, and you have folks set up with bins to separate the material, you need a tent, you need shade, you need water. This is hard work. You're not going to take all your binds and just have some folks sitting around in a field at some tables maybe without the appropriate stuff to make sure they're well cared for. So there are logistics to this that are important.
Yep. And you'll want to feed them, you'll want to water them, you'll want to, you know, make sure they're happy because you want them to come back, because to your point, this does suck. You know, people that want to come and help for free, per our previous episode, you know, they want to do it on their time. And if you are under the gun, you know, you have to stick to a schedule, you're going to have this mismatch in expectations, and that can be problematic.
So that's hand harvesting. I recommend trying it just once.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. That will tell you, give you that much more appreciation for mechanical harvesting.
It becomes a story to tell around the campfire.
Mm-hmm. But making that jump to small-scale mechanical harvesting is the first thing people think is that, oh my God, this is going to be so much easier. I can spend money to buy a piece of equipment that I don't have to worry about.
But yeah, there's a big easy button on the side.
There you go. It's a big easy button. Wrong. It's a whole nother world of issues. Certainly in the small scale, and having been, I think, the first company out there with a very, very small scale harvester, we found out very quickly that people's expectations do not match the real world in most cases.
Yep. And part of that gets back to the mechanical ability piece that we've talked about. And we've discussed the fact that you're very much a how do things work kind of person in that makerspace, and mm-hmm. that it's important to you to just know how things are doing what they're doing. But plenty of folks want the easy button. You know, I've got a right. lot of machines in my house, and I don't care how they work. I just want to push the button and get my damn toast out of it and be done.
Right.
But there is, just like we've spoken about with oasts and drying, you need to know how these things work because they will break.
They absolutely will break, and they will guaranteed break at the most inopportune time. So, yeah, any harvester of any scale, you're going to need to have good mechanical aptitude. And so many people would come to our classes, or even we had a couple of charter growers that they were not mechanically inclined at all, and they just thought they were going to spend their way into success. And, well, I've got a guy who's a mechanic who will come over and fix the harvester after work if it breaks. Okay, well, what happens if it breaks at 9:30 in the morning? Well, it's all right. We'll just, you know, get to it tomorrow. Oh, okay. And when your mechanic guy doesn't feel like coming over after work because he's just worked 12, 14 hours, then what?
Or he comes over and says, oh, you need this, this, and this part. We're going to have to order them.
Exactly. Well, then you say, well, just go down to the farm and fleet and get it. Well, no, you can't because they're metric. Oh, and they're custom. So those aspects of mechanical harvest cannot be understated, let's put it that way.
And there are certainly designs out there for purchase. And as you mentioned, I mean, we built several over the years with various degrees of success. The hardest part of that, you know, in addition to running a farm and running an equipment company, was, to your point, folks that are not mechanical saying, hey, how come it doesn't do exactly this? Well, one, because you didn't read the instructions. but two, because you need to be able to bend and twist with things.
Right.
You need to be able to be functional and work with this equipment. But you see a lot of designs out there on the message boards and the Facebook groups and people putting together their own ways of stripping binds. There are a lot of ways to do it. There are a lot of ways to botch it up, but it doesn't mean there's only one right way to do it either.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. And maybe we do that. Maybe later in the year we'll have an episode on, so you want to build your own harvester, because there are a few key attributes that will lead to success if you incorporate them.
I can't wait to do that one, because I think the Instagram picture post for it will just be someone covered in blood. A Night of the Living Dead shot.
Night of the Living Dead shot, correct. Yeah, that will happen. I mean, there's a reason why my wife called our first one Mangler Jr. So, because it was pretty brutal. Regardless of what tools you're using, small scale or moderate to large scale for harvest, it's really about bind management and how you get your crop out of the field and to the harvester. And it's like you're setting a cadence, and the cadence is the harvest activity proper. So how fast do plants move through that harvester? What are the bottlenecks there? Because you're always trying to make that more and more efficient. One thing that so many people neglect when they're dealing with mechanical harvesting is, what do you do with all of the garbage? And the first thing that generally happens is people say, well, we'll just, you know, shovel it out of the way or what have you. Yeah, that lasts about an hour, because you quickly realize that most of the biomass of that plant is garbage. It's just, it piles up so fast. It's one person's job just to move the stuff. So that's usually the first thing people fix and add on to their system in the off season or the following year is some sort of way to move that leaves and bind debris and stuff out of the way.
And that's exactly what your volunteers want. If you're working with volunteers, is you're on garbage duty. You're just hauling binds back and forth.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. That's no better way than to guarantee that they won't come back.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to touch the pretty hop flowers.
Setting that cadence with the harvester is super important. I don't know how best to explain this. So let me just sort of talk through the picture I have in my head of our process. So you've got somebody feeding hop binds into a machine. And the feed rate determines basically how good of a pick you get. And every variety can be different. Every variety is a little bit too aggressive. I'd say variety families can be a bit different. You know, a Chinook picks differently than a Cascade, than a Tettnanger. So those rates, harvest rates, change. So if that's changing, everything downstream has to change as well to match. Because what you don't want to have happen is too many people in the field cutting binds, and then they come and they dump them, and then you can't get to them for an hour. As they wilt, those flowers become less and less harvestable. So what that means is you're going to run through your machine, they've lost moisture, they're going to shatter into bracts and stuff like that, and nothing's going to come out the back end. So it's like you've got to time the drop off of those plants so that they can be run through in a reasonable amount of time. I would say, you know, less than 20 minutes, or you're going to have issues with yield loss. People say, oh man, my hops look great. I've got all these flowers, but man, my yield and one, my dryer was awful. I don't know what's going on. And you look in their garbage pile and it just looks like confetti. It's like, well, you had way too much shatter. I've seen 50% yield loss due to cone shatter in a harvester.
Wow. And of course, it's not just yield loss. All of that shatter going on during the picking process creates more debris in your machine, which adds to the potential for jams and breakdowns and whatnot. So it all kind of compounds upon itself.
Yep. Getting those plants out of the field at the right cadence is really important. Like you said earlier about the harvester, it's the same thing as with getting plants out of the field. How do you do it? What's the best way? Everybody's a bit different, and we've done it a half a dozen different ways. But what it boils down to is the plant being cut at the bottom near the soil surface, I'd say with maybe about 6 inches above the soil surface. Then the plant being cut at the top wire. And then that plant, that bind or twine, being draped onto some sort of a cart or a flatbed or something of that nature. What you don't want to do is just let them drop into a pickup truck and then you've got a big snarled mess when you drop it off at the harvester, because that's going to very quickly wreck your harvest efficiency if that person feeding the equipment has to untangle everything. So how those binds are laid out and which direction they're laid out is very important. For instance, if you're running a wolf harvester, you want to feed that bind into the machine butt end first. So if you stack the binds incorrectly on your wagon and drop them off, now the end that you need to feed in the machine is the one that's furthest away from you.
I laugh because it's so easy to get wrong.
Oh, it is. And so if you've got pickup hooks that are dragging your plants right into the harvester, you've got a pickup block every 10 feet or so, and you're missing every other one. Your Wolf 140 is now a Wolf 70 because you're only hitting every other pickup block. Just that one simple thing, you know, dropping your plants backwards at the harvester site totally destroyed your efficiency. And these are the things you learn the hard way.
Yep.
What else did we do? What else can we talk about there? I would usually have one person cutting up top, one person cutting at the bottom, and 2 to 3 people loading binds onto a trailer. And this is for a Wolf 140 scale, 140, 170, so 140 to 170 pieces of twine per hour. They could pretty much keep up with our harvest rate. And so that's all they did all day long, was go out, cut, drop, go out, cut, drop, and repeat the next day. So we'd rotate the crews, but that was a pretty good rate. So that means right there I had 5 people in the field. I had one person running the wolf in terms of feeding the binds in. I had usually one person who was a floater. They'd go around, make sure that there wasn't too much leaf debris and whatnot in the hops coming out. They'd be the ones managing the garbage conveyor that was taking the leaf and stem debris out into a wagon. And then you had one person who was sort of the harvest coordinator. That was either me or my field supervisor. We were also the ones that fixed stuff when it broke. So there's 5 in the field, 6, 7, at least 8 of us that was required for, you know, to run that system efficiently.
And you think about all if you think at a very high level and you've never done this before, about all the tasks that need to be done, and it's just, okay, get the binds down, get them over to the harvester, run them through the harvester. It sounds like a lot less people than that. But to your point of all the things that get in the way, the debris being such a big elephant in the room, so to speak, it takes so many more hands on deck than it sounds like when you just talk about the simple process of getting from point A to point B.
Yep. And I would think, too, that one of the things that I had to get over relatively quickly was trying to solve all of these bottlenecks mechanically. That snowballs on you very quickly. If something breaks, it brings the whole system to a screeching halt. So I really very quickly changed gears and got away from thinking of how to solve things mechanically to how to better streamline a simpler harvest operation.
Sure. And if that simplicity meant a body doing something instead of a machine, that's what you do.
That's what you do. You'd like to think that, well, machines, you know, you get them running and they don't cost you anything. They break. And when they break, everything stops. So even if you have the worst employee or person doing a job, they're at least doing something. You still have forward momentum. But a machine, to your point, Greg, if you don't have the mechanical aptitude to immediately address mechanical issues, it's a total wrench in the works. Don't rely on machinery to fix your efficiency issues.
Yep. And if you are the anal retentive sort like I am, that machine breaks, and rather than taking 10 minutes to decide this is not fixable, we're going manual, I know I would spend 2 hours banging my head against the wall going, I've almost got it. And the time is just flying by.
That's experience, though, I think. Mm-hmm. To know when to, you know, as we say, fish or cut bait. And we would typically have it to the point where I wouldn't even bother on our scale hand harvesting. It just was not an option. If you had a significant malfunction, and for us, a significant malfunction would be the machine is down for a day. So now I've lost a day of harvest. And I had a machine shop in the barn. And people were like, wow, you have a mill and a lathe and all that stuff. I'm like, uh-huh. Because guess what? When you need it now. There's no running down to the farm shop and getting what you need. I mean, sometimes there is, but not always. Sometimes you got to make stuff. We had a main sprocket that actually drove the bind chain that drug the hops through the machine. That sprocket, it was cast iron. It was 40-some years old, split in half over the Friday before Labor Day weekend. And it's metric. It's a metric shaft size. It's a metric sprocket chain. So what are you going to do? Well, we were done for that day. But I called an old machinist friend of mine who was retired. And I'm like, can you come look at this? Because I don't, give me your opinion on what we should do. And he came and looked at it. He's like, oh, yeah, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we chatted a little bit, had a beer over it. And this was Friday evening. And the next morning I went to the farm because that's what you do as a farmer. And there's a box sitting in front of the harvester door. And I opened it up and it's a hand machined solid aluminum sprocket that he went home and made on his drill press that night.
Wow.
And I was like, or Jeff, what the hell? Thank you, but you didn't have to do that. He's like, yeah, my wife and daughter were away for the weekend. I had nothing else to do.
Wow.
And so, boom, we were back up and running. And I called the crew in, yep, on Saturday and Sunday and Monday to catch up over the holiday weekend because that's what you do. Mm-hmm. But in that scenario, that was how I solved that issue. And if I didn't have those connections, I would have been completely screwed.
So the moral of the story there is make friends.
Make friends with old machinists.
So going back a few minutes, when you started down the path of, you know, one of the things you learned was not to assume a machine is the answer to everything and be willing to go manual when you have to. I thought what was going to come out of your mouth was one of the things I learned early on was even though you, the owner, the manager of the farm, is the lead supervisor, learn very quickly that you can't do every task. And make sure that your folks at their various stations know what to do, but that you've given the autonomy to go ahead and do it. Because I think that's another way you can slow down dramatically in farming or any other way of life, not to trust the folks around you and not to lay it all on yourself and just get out of the way, I'll do it myself.
Yeah, you got to really get over that and very, very quickly. That's management skills.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we haven't even approached yet. You've got to trust but verify.
Yes.
So put the right people in the right positions. And yeah, I understand that so-and-so may want to run the harvester, but there ain't no way in hell it's happening. Because, yeah, right?
You can say Dan. It's okay. They know who he is.
No, I even trusted Dan to do this. We've had some folks work at the farm. I'm just like, ooh, you're going to kill yourself shaving one morning, buddy. So that idea of making sure you have the right people in the right place and then following up to make sure that they are engaged and doing what they need to do instead of just, you know, duffing it and loafing, really just stepping up when you come around. That's a big deal.
Yep. Especially because in many of these cases, you're dealing with hourly labor. They're getting paid for as long as they're there. They're not getting paid on throughput and yield.
So it was a few years ago, a friend of mine called me. He's got a big operation. He's got two Wolf 220 harvesters back to back. He's like, can you come over? Our harvest was done. He was quite a bit further north than us. So I'm like, yeah, well, I'll go up. So made the trek up north. And he's just like, I don't know. I think I need a third harvester. I'm like, dude, you only got 10 acres. What are you talking about? Third harvester. he's like, well, I want to, you know, be at 40 acres. And it's just weird just not making the time. It's like these Wolf 220s are not doing 220 pieces of twine an hour. Something's wrong. So, you know, I start looking over the equipment with him and his mechanic. And there are a few tweaks we made. But then he goes out in the field to keep tabs on his bind cutters. And I start watching the two guys that are feeding binds into the equipment. And as soon as he left, they went from hitting every bind hook to hitting every third or fourth bind hook. Yeah, his Wolf 220 is now a Wolf 70. And I came back, you know, when he came back and we were having beers at the end of the day, and I said, here's the numbers that I found. He's like, what's going on? I said, the two, you know, organ donors you have feeding binds into the machine are absolutely duffing it. As soon as you leave, they just really quit working.
Wow.
Immediately make that change. I even brought up my farm manager at the time, and she showed him. She was half their age in some cases and was like whipping binds around and hitting every bind hook and blah, blah, blah. And I remember this one guy, he was probably about her same age, mid-20s. He's like, oh, man, that looks like a lot of work. So I was like, if Hannah can hit every single pickup bind and whip those binds around, and I was like, yeah, you get a core workout. That's the way it works. That's how it needs to go. And yeah, she was doing it, hitting every, you know, she did it for an hour and she was hitting every bind hook. And, you know, lo and behold, she was running around that 200 pieces of twine an hour. Like, that's how you do it. And all of a sudden, the dryers are filling up, and he's like, whoa, we got to switch to the other dryer. That's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, trust but verify. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So there's so much of that we could go into. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to get too far off topic of, I guess we're not getting off topic, but I want to make sure we touch on the when to harvest.
Yes. Yes. So that's probably the most common question. You see it on the Facebook pages, the, you know, questions we get of, here's what my cones look like. Are they ready? Is it time? How do I know when it's time to harvest?
Well, you harvest when it's time.
That's a very aggravating answer.
Well, that's a variation on the it depends answer.
Yeah, I was just expecting that to come.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what do you think?
What do I think?
I know you have an angle on this topic of when to harvest. Like I said earlier, it was, there's two different answers there. There's the physiological answer of when is a cone at its peak ripeness and ready to harvest. And then there's the real life answer. Time to harvest is when you can get the harvest done.
Yeah, there's the when you can get it done and the when. I mean, when nature tells you it's ready or it's not ready, sometimes that doesn't go along with your real life situation. So we've spoken briefly about the fact that if there are hints of disease coming or, you know, or other reasons, or just from a staging perspective where you can't harvest everything at once and you must stage in order for your drying and harvesting equipment even at peak efficiency, get done, we need them to get done, you'll need to make some adjustments based on that.
The physiological answer is hops are at their peak, quote, ripeness, when they start to lose water, moisture content, as they mature. So they go into this phase called senescence. And that's basically cell death. The plant is dying. It's getting ready to go dormant. And so the hop cone will go from the low 80s% moisture content and drop into the 70s. And what we found, no matter what variety you're harvesting, is that 73 to 75% moisture content is the optimum harvest range. And a lot of that has to do with having enough moisture in the cone so that when you run it through a mechanical harvester, it doesn't just explode and shatter. So if you're overripe, if you're below 72% moisture content, I just see yields plummet when you mechanically harvest because the cones just disintegrate.
And, you know, we talked about this on a very early podcast. I think it was the one we called A Little Bit Dead on the Inside. And the yeah. whole idea of, they are dying a bit when you initially harvest. That's they sort of come over the hump to health. And when things start heading downhill, that's the time to do it.
That's the optimum time from a cone chemistry standpoint. Your aroma is not going to get any better if you leave them hang up there.
Now, of course, it's not like you're going to walk up to your hops and go, are you feeling sad today? Is it time? Is it time to pull you down? I mean, how do you see that this is happening?
Well, how do you know you're going into cell death is that you measure the moisture content. You're taking samples and you're measuring it. How are you measuring it? Well, remember in the Dan episode when we talked about microwave drying and the balance and weighing all that, you're looking at dry weight minus wet weight. So you mean I have to go out in my field and take samples and measure it? Yeah, that's how you do it.
Mm-hmm. The actual mathematical formula is in a haiku on our Instagram account.
It is. See if you can find it. This concept of, well, they should feel light and papery, or they're going to smell this way, or the lupulin changes color. None of those are signs of proper harvest timing. None of them. So you want to do this like the pros do it, then you measure the moisture content and you measure it using an aggregate sample from three different locations in the plant, you know, all the way up top, in the middle, and sort of head height. And that will give you an average moisture content. And when that thing says 75%, hit it. Time to go. It's not going to get any better if you leave them hang. You're not going to get any riper or more aroma if you leave them hang. Actually, it's going to go south on you very quickly. So get them off. Time to go. And so what happens if three of your varieties hit that 75% at the same time? Now what?
Now you have an equipment backup problem.
Yep. You've got a staging issue. That was part of pre-planning your yard to know that you can get all of those varieties off at the optimum time, or you're going to have to start making quality concessions. Mm-hmm. To your point earlier, the optimum time, technically optimum time for harvest, may not be the operationally optimum time for harvest. So some varieties you can get away with harvesting a bit earlier, you know, on the 78% moisture side, but other varieties, you know, won't tolerate it at all. Certainly if you need that extra time to build the aroma profile you're looking for. Like alpha and beta acids form far earlier than the aroma compounds. So if you've got an alpha variety that's going to need to harvest at the same time as an aroma variety, I'd take the alpha variety a little earlier because it's really not going to impact how that hop's going to be used in brewing because the alpha's already been built. And then come back for your aroma variety. So those are kinds of the concessions you have to make. Or, let's say, I think we talked about late season downy mildew. What are you going to do? You going to risk leaving your crop hang in the hopes that it's not that bad and you get some crop? Or are you going to take it early, just as the symptoms are starting to show because I can't spray anything at that point, and know that, well, at least I got my crop off. It's not optimum, but I still have it.
Mm-hmm. And you have to consider the pre-harvest interval at that point, that you can't treat for certain things that close to harvest.
Yep.
So you've got a judgment call to make there.
Exactly. So it's a total juggle that you're doing. And I mean, I really start weighing it, literally standing in the field, weighing samples and scratching my chin, usually around the third week of July. Because I would have some varieties like Tetanhanger that could harvest, if the season was right, could harvest as early as the last week of July. And if it didn't, that meant it was going to back up into Saaz and Centennial. So what's my strategy? Every year it was that way.
Yeah. And you had to make a call. And of course, we've said it so many times that until you experience it and you take some risks and see how they turn out, you just you learn from experience. That's why in the Pacific Northwest, some of these farms that have been around for multiple generations, they just know when it's time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still testing, they're still doing what you need to do, but there's a generational aspect of that where the soil is what it is after all this time. The environment is what it is, and the people have been at it for so long that you just know these things. Until you get at least a few years under your belt, you know, you're going to make some decisions, and some of them are going to pan out, and the ones that don't pan out are the ones you're really going to remember.
And we're fairly famous for saying things like, well, you can't feel hops until when they're dry in the dryer. Mm-hmm. That's true. But after, you know, spending 15 years doing it, I can get pretty damn close. I could, you know, when hops would come in for processing, people say, oh, yeah, the reported moisture content's 10.2. And I'd say, bullshit, it is. I'm like, these are at least 14 if they're not higher than that. And, oh, no, here's all my data. And then you go and I take a sample and I take it over and do the dry weight. And it turns out like 14.5%. And I just look at them. I'm like, take them back. So same thing goes with harvest. You learn over time what that variety is going to look like and smell like, and given your time of year. But I couldn't go someplace else in the state and tell somebody when to harvest theirs because it's different. Unless I use that moisture content method.
So you have to get away from gut and back to science, because it's not the gut of your experience of your farm. Mm-hmm. We've said it many times before. You can't even do from a maintenance and a management and a timing perspective. You can't even run your farm based on what the guy down the road is doing. It's also very, very unique.
Yeah, all we can do is give you the why things happen, so you know how to adjust what you're doing on your site.
All right, so where does that put us here on I'll say phase one of harvest planning?
Hide. No, not an option.
No, as with most things, we end these conversations and say, did we just talk people out of doing this again?
Well, this is the entire goal of your business plan is to get these hops off, and for the love of everything, I hope that you had considered it before it was time to do it, because it's a logistical challenge to get all these things balanced, and you still have a smidge of time to make sure you've got all those things lined up. But ultimately, I think what it comes down to is pre-planning, and I think you said it, it's like failing to plan is planning to fail. Mm-hmm. This harvest is one of those times where it's just absolutely brutal, because you will find, and sometimes very painfully, all of the poor assumptions that you made earlier in the year.
Yeah, I can't stress enough the planning side of things. It's just, and the tricky part, especially for a new grower, is not knowing what to plan for. I mean, I go back to what we just talked about with all the waste material when you're harvesting. It's probably not something that you consider until you're tripping over it. And knowing ahead of time, you know, I got to dedicate a whole person to waste removal? What are you talking about? And designate an area to dump all this stuff? Or someone who's constantly running back and forth, just carting it off the farm? Why do I need a whole body to do that? Well, because that's what it is. But if you've never harvested before, that's likely one of those things you're going to run right into and not even have thought in your wildest dreams would be an entire body reward. Did we just talk people out of doing this again? Oh.